Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Clean Tech, a roundup of the week's biggest stories you need to know in climate and clean energy in 15 minutes or less. Today is Friday, March 22nd, 2024. I'm Renewable Energy World Editor-in-Chief John Engle. Andrew Mosman from Heatmap will be joining us shortly, but for now I'm joined by clean tech PR veteran and everyone's favorite techno-optimist, Mike Casey of TigerCom. Hello, Mike. How's your voice this week?
It's very good, Mr. Engle. I just got back in California last night, so I missed two of my son's scream-worthy soccer games.
Thank goodness.
But I want you to know, I've got good news and I have bad news.
Oh, no. All right,
the good news is that at one of our clients, I was stopped in the hallway by one of the employees that said they love the show. Cool, right? Bad news for you is
This is so predictable from you, Mike.
They want the no pen. I'm just telling you.
No.
They want the no pen, John.
I don't know that any of these stories are real. All right. With that, we want to thank all of you for nominating your Clean Techers of the Week, which we'll get to at the end of the show, as well as those story recommendations. Keep them coming. Send them to rew@clarionevents.com. We'll have a link in the episode description as well. All right, Mike, let's get started with story number one.
Jennifer Hiller and Brian McGill from the Wall Street Journal wrote a story called How the World's Biggest Plane Would Supersize Wind Energy. This is where you start harshing on novel new initiatives, John, so I am bracing myself, but you are first.
But here's the thing. I sent you this one. So I think everyone would expect that this was a Mike Casey originated story, but I saw this and was like, oh, that's kind of cool. I don't know that it would ever work. And I have no, you know, background in physics to say that we can do, you know, multi-football field long planes to carry wind turbine blades. But here's the gist. So unicorn startup Radia plans to build the world's largest plane at about 356 feet in length to transport wind turbine blades the length of football field. So we know it's really hard to get blades across the country once they reach a port. And that's one of the major issues facing the wind industry, which has struggled of late. The massive blades used in offshore wind can generate twice the energy of onshore wind installations, but are very difficult to move around on land. And with these planes, developers could build a 6,000-foot packed dirt runway at their project site and put up more powerful turbines. Boy, does it sound good in print, Mike, but what do you think?
See, do you see the subtle harshing, listeners and viewers?
What do you mean? The military hasn't even built a plane this big. So I think it's cool, but it's a little, I don't know.
All right. First, I'm volunteering to ride on this plane's first flight. Oh. I think it would be super cool. John, if you'd like to, can come. And the second is that Jeff Bezos is surely going to buy one, put in a pool, a gym, and a suntanning booth inside his. I think that's a safe prediction. So community opposition will be interesting in this one. We know that view shed is a primary concern, and bigger blades mean that they're going to be more visible than NIMBYs, but it also means they'll be able to harvest more wind and improve the economics of wind farms. So that's good. The plane looks like the best option for increasing the size of onshore projects. Building blades on site would require temporary football field structures, helicopters costly and dangerous, and blimps cannot land when it's windy.
But what about can it fly?
John,
not just the NIMBYs, man. That's a huge plane.
You're such a nudge in these little details. I think you just need to move to story number two and get off your Debbie Downer.
I will, but before I do that, remember like mid last year when the viral story came out about like this nuclear powered, basically like a cruise ship in the air, and it got shared everywhere, and everyone's like, "Wow, we've really done it. We figured it out, guys." All right. Anyway, it reminds me of that. Jamie Smith from the Financial Times wrote a story. Bill Gates' TerraPower plans to build the first U.S. next generation nuclear plant. Mike, what do you think?
This story is sure to set hearts aflutter among LinkedIn's legions of nuclear bros. So They'll enjoy this in a race with Russia and China to develop and export cost-efficient small modular reactors, otherwise known as SMRs. Bill Gates' TerraPower plans to build nuclear power plants with reactors cooled by liquid sodium rather than water. Power capacity 345 megawatts would slash the cost of standard light water reactors in half because they're built with simpler materials and operate at lower pressures, requiring fewer safety systems. As always, there's the question of what to do with the highly radioactive waste that's dangerous for more than 10,000 years, and I doubt any of the advocates for these things are willing to live near the resulting dump sites. Just saying. John?
So here's my thought. The last calendar year was tough for nuclear, and especially SMRs, NuScale taking that big hit when the canceled project out in Utah. But look here. So NuScale's having a bit of a bounce back. They've got some other projects in the pipeline, are telling investors not to worry. We have a plan B and we're ready to scale. And I think the key in this story again is Bill Gates. It's in the headline. And you saw the announcement last week from Microsoft and Google saying, we're going to partner up to tell the private industry, we will buy your clean firm because we know we can't get enough power for our data centers. So I think the market is still there, and the Amazons, the Microsofts, and the Googles are willing to pay a surplus to get that reliable clean firm power. I don't think that we're done with SMRs. I'm not sure where we go from here, and I don't think they're going to be a significant slice of the pie like Duke Energy would like us to think in their 2035 carbon plans. But I think the story is getting marginally better for nuclear, and specifically SMRs. Mike, story number three.
I'll just note, Mr. Engel, in our undisclosed race to sound more and more like Jim Cramer, you just took the lead. That was a Jim Cramer-like kind of talk up
of
that story.
Don't compare me to Jim Cramer. He's the inverse investor. You usually go the opposite way of Jim Cramer. That's what the Reddit forums tell you to do. All right, let's move on before we get sued.
Okay. Story written by Lisa Friedman from the New York Times, the zombies of the U.S. tax code. Why fossil fuels subsidies seem impossible to kill. Mr. Engel, you're up first.
Yeah, fourth attempt, President Biden requesting Congress to eliminate the $35 billion in tax breaks over the next decade to oil and gas companies who are already experiencing record profits. Make that note, they get subsidies too. The tax breaks have made new oil and gas projects worth billions more each year and up to $20 billion more in high oil price years. These decades-old subsidies continue despite the fact that last year, America was the world's largest crude oil producer and exporter of liquefied natural gas. And rather than investing that money into their companies, what are they doing? M&A and stock buybacks. Mike, what do you think?
So this story needs to be the first that we all cite when we hear the reliable harshing by the fossil fuel lobby about popular pro-clean energy policies. Let's be clear. Oil executives argue that 46% of energy subsidies between 2016 and 22 were for clean energy, so they shouldn't be singled out. And I am calling bovine excrement on this one. And I, John, I'm sorry.
Damn it.
Here's the thing that CEOs of ExxonMobil and Aramco don't want to admit. They are subsidized, and they have been for a century. And they spend heavily to stay on the dole, $130 million a year, which is almost certainly a fraction of the actual total. So here's the thing. If subsidization is the sign of immaturity, that makes oil and gas the oldest toddler on the planet. And after a century of feeding at the corporate welfare trough, isn't it time that oil and gas stood on its own 2 feet? All right, John, end of filibuster. Over to you for four stories.
Yeah, and I'm going to take this one on my own, Mike, so that we can get to Andrew here in just a minute, because our rambling is cutting into our time. Fourth story is from Jonathan Leake from The Telegraph, which I thought was really interesting. I flagged this one as well. Britain to import energy from U.S. under plan for transatlantic power cable. So the gist here is some private investors want to install up to six power cables across 3,500 miles of the Atlantic Ocean that could allow Britain to import energy from the U.S. This takes a step toward a global interconnected grid, which would take advantage of peak demand changes across time zones. At a high level, that would be cool. Can we do it? Yes. And we reported on this as well at Power Grid International. I think the consensus from the energy Twitter users of the world who we follow so closely is that it's possible. Yes. Very, very expensive. And this one from Chris Clack, the former researcher turned policy guy over at Pattern Energy, said, we can't even interconnect our grids in North America on land. We're trying to interconnect transatlantic countries to improve, to make this global grid. It's interesting to see it's being considered by regulators. It costs $20 billion or $25 billion, excuse me. Don't think it's going to happen, but it was an interesting one. All right, Mike, why don't you welcome our guest here?
I will do so. I just want to note there are no county commissions on the floor of the Atlantic on the floor of the Atlantic Ocean. Just saying. All right, that's our funny. Last story.
That was good.
That was pretty good.
I'm really impressed to see that coming from you, Mike.
All right. We're welcoming Andrew Moser,
who's reconsidering his decisions.
Is it better to save your solar or to sell it? Andrew, you're going to bring some adult supervision here. Thank you for that. For people who have not read your piece yet, could I just ask, what's the big takeaway?
The big takeaway is, it's really about my sort of pet thing I've been obsessed with over the last year or so, which is the idea of going from, the old way of, energy goes from the power company to you, to the sophisticated way of the future in which energy moves in every single direction. And so I was thinking about, what's going on with the states and some of the big utilities really pushing back on net metering and which was obviously sort of the first big kind of incentive for to give, people with big solar on their rooftops a way to make back some of that investment. And that kind of going away in favor of, a bigger push to get people to have home batteries, to store that stuff for later instead of selling it back on the grid, and really what that means for how energy is going to move around in the future.
Andrew, I'm going to be candid in that I don't know what to think about rooftop solar anymore. I have no clue. Like, is it still an important part of the mix? Is it too expensive? You look at California specifically, because that's the driver of the national market. And as moves California will determine whether these national brands can even survive. Net metering. Okay. Then there's a cost shift, and no, there's not a cost shift, or it's not as pronounced as we thought it was going to be. But then when you have net metering and it's critical to scaling up a market, it may eventually wreck your grid. High costs. We should be building more utility scale. I don't know where to land anymore. Where should I land? Find me a runway on rooftop solar's role going forward.
Yeah, I don't know what to think either. I think that when I first started reading about all this stuff, I found it. I was very cynical about the pushback against net metering because it seemed like utilities and powers that be kind of just saying we don't really want to deal with that anymore. We don't, we don't want to pay you a wholesale price for this. We don't want to have to deal with a whole lot of your energy being backfed on the grid and us having to manage that. I wasn't involved in this, but Heatmap actually this week on their podcast did an entire segment about this very question about whether, rooftop is worthwhile or.
Yeah. We talked about that on last week's show too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But the thing that I think you should land on is that it's a big open question as far as the economics and how it relates to things flowing back onto the grid. But it's still a huge deal for the question of resilience, microgrids, that idea of future energy, of people being able to, sort of bank their own solar, use it for later. Establishing something like that where neighborhoods, businesses, whoever can island themselves. That's the key thing for me when I think about rooftop solar is it's essential to the distributed idea of clean energy in the future.
So Andrew, I'm gonna resolve this debate by giving John the opinion he should have going forward. I can go ahead. Yeah. So
I don't want this. I didn't ask for this. I asked Andrew to land the plane. I don't know where your plane's going with the jacuzzis and sun tanning beds and Jeff Bezos.
I don't have any of those things.
That's such a good callback by me. But I'm, can we be honest?
But I am here to tell you that rooftop solar on people's houses is absolutely essential for the clean energy transition. It's a reason for conservative voters skeptical about global climate disruption to buy in on their terms. That cannot be underestimated given the polarization we have in this country. And I think it's also critical, Andrew, for the reasons that you talked about. And I think that the success of the persistent effort by utilities to want to get want to get paid for people buying less of their product. You know, in New Jersey 30 years ago, they had a name for that. It's called protection money. And we have the equivalent of that in net metering 3.0, which is, I don't want to have to pay you what I charge you when you sell me stuff that I sell you. I mean, it's just, it's really a reconciliation to the flexible grid world that we're heading to.
The political thing that you brought up is really interesting too, because when I first started thinking about this sort of thing in terms of home resilience, you know, home resilience, you typically think of in terms of kind of a conservative libertarian prepper, get off the grid sort of way. Like, this is doing it, but with lefty clean energy. So there's a connection there that I think is important.
John, we are just about out of time. We need to go to our clean techer of the week.
Yeah, it's Sylvia Martinez, principal analyst at WoodMac. Last week, she was part of organizing a team for the 2024 delegation of the Let's Share the Sun Foundation, a great group which helps install rooftop solar in isolated areas. Her team helped install a 2.7 kilowatt solar installation on a home in Puerto Rico. Sylvia will be posting her biggest takeaways from the trip on LinkedIn this week, so you'll have to check that out. We'll link that profile in the description as well. So congratulations to Sylvia.
I want to thank our terrific producer, Brian Mendez, and Alex Peterson and Claire Quirin for helping gather these stories this week.
Yeah, and thanks to Andrew Mosman for joining us on this episode of This Week in Clean Tech. Please subscribe, give us feedback, and share your story recommendations and nominations for Clean Tech of the Week. You can read all those articles we discussed this week by clicking the links in the episode description. All right, Mike, we'll see you next time. Thanks, Andrew.
On our 31st episode next week, John, this wow. puts the 30th one on the books.
Time flies when you're having fun. I truly am having fun, Mike. So this is a highlight of my week. All right.
I like giving you your opinions, John. I'll give you more next week. Take care.
I wasn't listening. I muted you.
Take care.
Hey, it's John Engel, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.